Well, good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Aren't we lucky to be here? There's no forest fire nearby, and no smoke, and it's beautiful. I hope you like this place as much as we did when we discovered it a few years ago. So this morning during Zazen, I read a quote from Zen Master Dogen, or sometimes I'll call him Dogen Zenji, which means Zen Master Dogen. He was the founder of Soto Zen, our particular stream of Zen, or Zaodong in Chinese. He founded this school in the 13th century in Japan as a young man. In his early 20s, he's only maybe 23 or so, he made the dangerous sea voyage to China to find a more authentic Zen practice than what he had experienced in Japan in his training since he was about 12. And he practiced in China for 3 years, about, and then returned to teach this particular style of practice that he learned from his teacher, Rujing. Dogen's writings are just full of references to the changing seasons, the natural world, and the Dharma teachings that we can receive from the world around us as the body of the Buddha. One of his most beloved writings, at least as it has become known in the West, is called the Mountains and Waters Sutra. And so we named this session after it because we love it so much. And we'll be drawing from it in our practice, in our talks today. Mountains and waters have been associated in many traditional earth-based spiritual traditions with powerful archetypal qualities. Mountains with height, transcendence, solidity, brightness, sometimes danger. And water with fluidity, transformation, nourishment, and sometimes danger. We could see in them yang and yin, as the Chinese did, male and female, qualities that we all have within us because we are made of earth, water, fire, and air. And in Buddhist thought, mind is the fifth element, interestingly. In Japanese folk Buddhism, mountains are associated with images of a fierce protective deity called Fudo Myo. And that's him, right there. Fudo means unmoving, and Myo means bright king, or, and the bright is referring to bright wisdom. He's a fierce-looking figure. He looks more like some of the deities in Tibetan Buddhism, and he's linked to Vajrayana Buddhism. He often has one blind eye and two fangs, one up, one pointing up and one pointing down. Okay, that guy, he doesn't have fangs. He's a very roughly carved Fudo. There was a Japanese monk and sculptor called Enku, and I think he was maybe in the 18th century, but I'm not sure, who went around Japan rough carving cedar Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of every kind, and just producing prodigious amounts of these images and then just giving them away. They're all over Japan and temples. And he became very beloved, and that's an Enku style Fudo. He often carries a sword. He has a sword there. The sword is to cut through delusion. And he's often depicted standing in the middle of a ring of flames, or seated on a craggy rock. So you might find a craggy rock to sit on and be unmoving, bright mind sometime this weekend. His unmoving quality is not a kind of rigid immobility, but a dynamic stillness, stable and poised, ready to move in an instant to respond to the world around. But not blown back and forth, as most of us are most of the time, by the eight worldly winds: pleasure and pain, loss and gain, fame and infamy, and praise and blame. Have you been blown back and forth by any of those lately? Yeah, most of us are. So Fudo doesn't get blown about, but he's also not rigid. So it's a very dynamic figure, and hence the ring of flames, which is, you know, kind of our world sometimes. This figure of Fudo is particularly revered by a sort of mountain ascetic cult in Japan. They're called Yamabushi, who would go on long mountain walking pilgrimages and do ascetic practices such as standing under a very cold waterfall and chanting the Heart Sutra at the top of your lungs, wearing only a loincloth. This practice generates chi, or ki. It also generates a sense of camaraderie with the others you're doing it with, as Michael can attest, because he's done it, as I have not. Though women do this practice as well, usually wearing a white cotton kimono. Want to try it sometime? We can find a waterfall, I'm sure. A contrasting and complementary image, often associated with water, is Guanyin, or in Japanese, Kannon. And she's over here. She's most often, originally in India, Avalokiteshvara was depicted as male, but as this figure of this bodhisattva traveled through China and into Japan, it became more and more feminine. So in Japan, pretty consistently, it's a feminine figure who often stands, not this one, but often she stands on a rock amid ocean waves, or rides in a little boat, or even, yeah. These complementary images are images of wisdom and compassion. The mountain wisdom and the nourishing water of compassion. And they're considered the two wings of our practice. Our practice isn't balanced unless we cultivate both. Using images like this is not something we're really accustomed to in our culture. But when Michael and I lived in Japan, we really came to see and feel how deeply meaningful these images and beloved these images are in traditional Japanese culture, and to even to a great extent today. So I wonder, and I hope that in time we'll create images that meld these archetypal beings with the materials and the energies of this land. Our stone, our trees, our wood. And that maybe in your time here you'll feel some Fudo energy or some Kannon energy as you practice with the mountains and waters here. The quote that I read this morning was the opening paragraph, the opening lines from the Mountains and Waters Sutra. So let's listen to it again. Mountains and waters right now are the actualization of the ancient Buddha way. each abiding in its phenomenal expression, that just means it's arising in the phenomenal world, realizes completeness. Because mountains and waters have been active since before the empty aeon, they are alive at this moment. The empty aeon is part of Buddhist cosmology. World systems come into being and pass out of being. Universes are born and die, and they have four eons or stages. Beginning, abiding, decaying, and empty. You know, so then a new world is born out of that emptiness or that potential. And it takes a very long time in each of those stages for that to occur. They're called, if you ever hear the word kalpas in Buddhist term, a kalpa is one of these eons. And I believe a kalpa is the length of time that it takes for a mile-high mountain to wear down through a heavenly being passing over and brushing the mountaintop with her robe, her silken robe, once about every 100 years. So the time it takes to wear that mountain down is a kalpa. So, you know, exceedingly long. And so these take kalpas and kalpas, these cycles. So he's saying, because mountains and waters have been active since before the empty aeon, they are alive at this moment. Because they have been the self since before form arose, they are liberation realization. Dogen's not easy to understand using our conventional rational materialist minds, as you will see the more we read. So please don't try to understand him that way. Understand him without words, with your body, with your senses, with silence and sound, with stillness and movement. And you'll begin to see that mountains and rivers are us. So I'm going to read it again, and I'm going to change it just a little. Each of us, right now, is the actualization of the ancient Buddha way. Each abiding in our phenomenal expression realizes completeness. Because we have been active since before the empty aeon, we are alive at this moment. Because we have been the boundless self since before form arose, we are liberation realization. Dogen continues with a quote from a Chinese Zen master, Furong Daokai, who lived a bit over 100 years before Dogen did. The blue mountains are always walking. A stone woman gives birth to a child at night. So then here's Dogen's commentary on Furong's words. Furong's really giving us two koans here, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. Dogen comments, mountains do not lack the qualities of mountains. Therefore, they always abide in ease and always walk. You should examine in detail the quality of mountains walking. Mountains walking is just like human walking. Accordingly, do not doubt mountains walking, even though it does not look the same as human walking. The Buddha ancestors' words point to walking. This is fundamental understanding. You should penetrate these words. Whenever he says you should penetrate these words, it means he's giving us a koan. Now, some of you might not be familiar with that word or exactly what it is. You might think, oh, a Zen koan is, you know, what is the sound of one hand clapping? They're sort of riddles that are really hard to understand. And yeah, they are kind of like that. They're hard to understand with our conventional mind. They come from stories. Sometimes they're just very, very short, one line. Sometimes there's a little story that goes with it, and they tend to be conversations between ancient Chinese Zen masters and a monk, or two monks with each other. And they're playful. They're ways of jostling us loose from our conventional dualistic thinking. And in some Zen traditions, the Zen teacher will give the student a koan to practice with, and the student will give a response until the teacher is satisfied. In our school of Zen, we don't really do that practice, but Dogen's writings are full of koans. And so it's good for us to not be afraid of them, and to be a little creative in how we practice with them. So I'm going to suggest a little bit how to make Blue Mountains walking into your koan. Or how are Blue Mountains walking and our walking the same, not different? You'll have to do some walking to find out. Okay. He continues, "People outside the mountains do not realize or understand the mountains walking. Those without eyes to see mountains cannot realize, understand, see, or hear this as it is. If you doubt mountains walking, you do not know your own walking. It's not that you don't walk, but that you do not know or understand your own walking." Well, think about that. Most of us, most of the time, walk about mindlessly and do not understand our own walking. As perhaps people did in earlier times when walking was an everyday necessity. You know, we live in the days where people drive a block to the 7-Eleven or the Starbucks. The American poet Gary Snyder, in his 1990 classic, now classic, The Practice of the Wild, collection of essays, points out that people of wilderness, people who live in the wild, rarely seek out adventures. Adventures right there. Who needs to induce adventure when, as the Haida say, the world is as sharp as the edge of a knife? Feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? Feels like the world's as sharp as the edge of a knife. You know, in the wilds of the city, in the wilds of our own home. So this is Gary Snyder. He says, "How does it look from the standpoint of peoples for whom there is no great dichotomy between their culture and nature? Those who live in societies whose economies draw on uncultivated systems. The pathless world of wild nature is a surpassing school, and those who have lived through her can be tough and funny teachers. Out here, one is in constant engagement with countless plants and animals." Right? Countless. "To be well educated is to have learned the songs, proverbs, stories, sayings, myths, and technologies that come with this experiencing of the non-human members of the local ecological community. Practice in the field is foremost. Walking is the great adventure, the first meditation, a practice of heartiness and soul primary to humankind. Walking is the exact balance of spirit and humility. Out walking, one notices where there is food." Have you seen any food out there? The thimbleberries are a little bit dry. Few of us grew up walking in this way. Maybe some of us did. From early childhood, I practiced walking silently in the woods. I had a little golden book or something called Little Beaver. He was a little Indian boy. And it said he walked silently in the woods, so I decided that I would do likewise. I'd learned to walk so as not to step on a stick that might snap and betray my presence to a doe browsing with her fawn. I learned the names of birds and trees and flowers, but my life did not depend on that knowledge. Or at least my physical survival didn't. Thinking back, I think perhaps my spiritual survival did. I asked Michael if he'd mind if I gave the first Dharma talk, because in the sutra it starts with mountains and then it moves to waters. And I wanted to do the part about mountains walking, because I was reading a wonderful book called Wanderlust, A History of Walking, by a wonderful essayist called Rebecca Solnit. In her introduction, she points out that walking can be invested with wildly different cultural meanings, from the erotic to the spiritual, from the revolutionary to the artistic. Right? We walk in protest. We walk to on a spiritual quest. We walk for exercise. We walk sometimes as art, artistic expression. And walking has sexual evocations as well. And she devotes a chapter to each of these. Fascinating stuff. But ideally, she says, walking is a state in which the mind, the body, and the world are aligned as though they were three characters finally in conversation together. Three notes suddenly making a chord. Walking allows us to be in our bodies and in the world without being made busy by them. Walking allows us to be in our bodies and in the world without being made busy by them. This is why walking meditation is such an important part of our practice. It is how we experience our body in relation to the world. In movement. Walking is how we measure our bodies against the world. We pace off a distance. That's the first way we measured distance, right? By pacing. Solnit writes, walking shares with making and working that crucial element of engagement of the body and the mind with the world. Of knowing the world through the body and the body through the world. This engagement of body and world is why it's also so important in our Zen practice that our Zen practice is not just sitting motionless on our cushions, but it's ringing bells or pounding the han or chopping carrots, cooking rice, sweeping leaves, just doing each thing fully engaged, fully awake. Walking is what links us to our work and play and to each other. Here's Gary Snyder again. He says, practically speaking, a life that is vowed to simplicity, appropriate boldness, good humor, gratitude, unstinting work and play, and lots of walking brings us close to the actually existing world and its wholeness. That's one of my favorite Gary Snyder lines. No other animal walks upright in the way that we do, with hands free to manipulate the material world in ever more sophisticated ways. Rebecca Solnit quotes John Napier, who was one of the first anthropologists to claim that upright walking began even earlier in human prehistory than was previously believed. And he says, human walking is a unique activity during which the body, step by step, teeters on the edge of catastrophe. Our bipedal mode of walking seems potentially catastrophic because only the rhythmic forward movement of first one leg and then the other keeps us from falling flat on our face. Right? And if something impedes that, we fall flat on our face. Solnit comments that this is easiest to see in small children, right? For whom the many aspects that will later unite seamlessly into walking are still distinct and awkward. You know, watch a toddler. She says, they learn to walk by flirting with falling. They lean forward with their body and then rush to keep their legs under that body. Their plump, bowed legs always seem to be lagging behind or catching up. And they often tumble into frustration before they master the art. Most of us don't really remember how that feels, to be little and learning how to walk. But maybe some of us have had the experience of relearning how to walk after a bad injury. Anybody ever had that experience where you had to learn how to walk again? I've just read about it and heard about it from people who have. But I think it must feel something like that, that feeling of tipping forward and then learning how to move the feet in that rhythm. So you might want to experiment a little with the sensations of walking during our time here, slowing down enough to feel that balance shift, the leaning forward on the brink of catastrophe, and the rear foot swinging forward to take our weight, keep us moving. Particularly notice when you're going up and down hill. Really notice how the body moves going up and down hill. Or if you're on rough surface, what you need to do to how you need to extend your awareness. We'll be walking more than usual during this session. So it's a great opportunity to practice. Dogen says, you should study the Blue Mountains using numerous worlds as your standards. You should clearly examine the Blue Mountains walking and your own walking. You should also examine walking backward and backward walking and investigate the fact that walking forward and backward has never stopped since the very moment before form arose, since the time of the king of the empty eon. If walking stops, Buddha ancestors do not appear. If walking ends, the Buddha Dharma cannot reach the present. Walking forward does not obstruct walking backward. Walking backward does not obstruct walking forward. This is classic Dogen. This kind of language kind of makes your head spin, doesn't it? But he's talking here of walking as our continuous practice. We move forward, we step back. We breathe in, we breathe out. We live, we die. Continuously cycling, right? That's what he's talking about here. In another writing of teaching of Dogen's called Fukan Zazengi, which are give his basic instructions for Zazen, he asks us to cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. That's what we think of mindfulness practices, taking the backward step to illuminate our body-mind. But not detached from the world around us, in constant relationship with the world around us. When we do that, he says, when we take that backward step, body and mind of themselves will drop away and your original face will be manifest. Your original face is you, not separate from all other phenomena. Right? That's your original face. So Dogen says, walking forward does not obstruct walking backward. Walking backward does not obstruct walking forward. This is called the mountains flow and the flowing mountains. So now mountains are taking on the qualities of water. He says there is walking, there is flowing. There is a moment when a mountain gives birth to a mountain child. So this cycles us back to the second koan of the two-part koan that Dogen started out with from Furong. The Blue Mountains are always walking, and a stone woman gives birth to a child at night. What a mysterious sentence that is. Yeah. So night, darkness in Zen literature refers to the absolute, the undifferentiated, the unified. And day or light refers to the relative, to the differentiated everyday world. In the poem we chanted this morning, the title's translated different ways, and I always get it: emerging of difference in unity, identity of relative and absolute. It has different translations. But it says, we chanted this morning, light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. Simultaneously functioning, not separate, alternating as the earth turns towards and away from the sun, as we swing one foot forward and the other becomes the one behind. Dogen explains the stone woman in koan. He says, it means that the moment when a barren woman gives birth to a child is called night. So that's his explanation. So what's the explanation mean? A barren woman, an infertile woman giving birth to a child. An impossible thing in those days. Maybe not today, but then it was. But in the night, in non-dual reality, stones become women, and they give birth. Dogen was writing in a time when folklore was full of stories of men becoming stones, stones becoming women. Stones were seen as powerful, right? Even sentient in their way. Unlike our own culture, cultures in other times and places have been more comfortable with the realms of dream and imagination being woven into everyday life. Dogen says, you should understand the meaning of giving birth to a child. At the moment of giving birth to a child, is the mother separate from the child? You should study not only that you become a mother when your child is born, but also that you become a child. This is the actualization of giving birth in practice realization. You should study and investigate this thoroughly. So he's saying, once again, you should study this, investigate this thoroughly. He means, I'm giving you a koan. How does a stone woman give birth at night? How is it that when a mother gives birth to a child, she also gives birth, she also becomes a child? Even stone women can awaken. Even stone men can give birth to mountain children. So you've got two koans there. You've got the blue mountains are always walking. And you've got a stone woman gives birth to a child at night. So don't try and figure these out, please. Don't try and make sense of them. But let them resonate through the time that you're here. Breathe them in and out as you sit, as you walk, as you stand, lie down at night, and pay attention to your experience in each moment, with each step, with each breath. Just pay attention. So thank you. Thank you for listening.